This is Out of School, the podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by a special guest again tonight. We've got three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Mac, iPad, iPhone and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Secondly, the show is brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes and more. And finally, this episode is sponsored by XMA and the HP Chromebooks 11 and 14. And we'll tell you more about all of that as the show goes on. So firstly, let me introduce Patrick Fogarty, a good friend, somebody who I have followed long on Twitter and followed me back. And I've been trying to kind of organize an opportunity to get him on the show for a while, and it's finally happening. So welcome, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Fraser. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here talking to you today.
Great. Well, I'm really glad you could make it. Bradley is still sunning himself in Florida, which is he keeps sending me little pictures of where he is. You know, he's right on a beachfront, and it's pouring down with rain here. So, you know, that's our comparative little weather report for the week. But anyway, let's leave Bradley to the sun. Patrick, give the listeners a little bit of your background first, and then we'll get into some of the topics we've lined up for tonight.
Sure. I've taken a pretty interesting road to become the IT director of Valley Stream 30, which is a smaller district in Long Island, New York, where I recently relocated. I started as a classroom teacher. I spent a little less than a decade in classrooms, and then actually, this is where your path intersects with mine. Kevin McCormick, the principal at the school I was working at, Xaverian, invited you to come speak there, and he had put me in charge of the one-to-one deployment, which was interesting because I had been using Mac stuff for maybe 3 years, and I was actually using like an Android phone. I was sort of switching from iOS to Android, which certainly was halted in its tracks. And when you came to speak, we sort of codified what we had in mind for our one-to-one program. It was very helpful for us because we had a lot of big ideas, but then there's the practical application of all those wonderful ideas that, you know, we kind of needed some focus and direction. So you came through and we really enjoyed that, and that I think helped set our course. Not just you, but other folks who we had visit us helped set the course for the next year or so. And I would say, like, within 2 years, we had the school 1-to-1, 6 through 12, which was really exciting. It was roughly 1,100 students, depending on the year. And from there, I was asked to work with the Diocese of Brooklyn and Queens, which is a 30,000 seat private school district, probably top five private school districts in the United States as far as size goes. And after doing the iPads at Xaverian, the Chromebooks were a godsend in the diocese because they were cheaper, they were so much easier to manage, which I'm sure we'll touch upon at some point. And it was just, that was a way a lot of schools wanted to go. So I then had experience with the iOS and the Chromebook deployment. I wrote a book called Going One-to-One, iPads and Mobile Devices in Education. And that sort of led me to a company called eSpark, then kind of aggressively recruited me. They were a private company. They brought me aboard to lead their implementation team, which was like a national team that goes into schools, make sure your infrastructure and network is ready for eSpark deployment. And eSpark is a whole complicated thing to explain in of itself, but it's essentially like a Pandora for apps, which they hate when I say, but I say it anyway. Then working for eSpark, after about a year of that, I have two small kids, so the travel got to be a lot, and I jumped over to Valley Stream 30 to serve as their director of technology.
Okay, great. Yeah, I fondly remember my visit to Xaverian. It was quite an interesting experience for me because it was kind of two ends of 1 week, and the start of the week I had been in Abilene, Texas, speaking at Abilene Christian University. Mm-hmm. And then I flew to New York and I was picked up by some of your guys from the airport there. And the cultural contrast between flying from rural West Texas to New York was almost took my brain apart. And I was like, you know, in Texas, you know when somebody's unhappy with you. And in New York, I thought, oh, man, these guys really hate each other. You know, like, no, hang on a minute. This is just what the New Yorkers are like. You know, so,
yeah, it's even worse out here on Long Island. So we're pretty. I don't know if brash is the right word. Whatever word it is, it's definitely unique for visitors, especially Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island are like different planets.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. I sensed some of that rivalry as well while I was there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was a good time. I still have my Zaverian sweatshirt that Kevin gave me. I still wear it from time to time. So,
and yet, after 10 years of working there, I did not get a free sweatshirt. So, a little bit jipped there.
Okay, so eSpark. Let's talk about that for a little second. I mean, you described it as Pandora for apps. It's more than just an MDM, is that right?
Yeah, so eSpark, we built, or I shouldn't say we, I should say the really brilliant people who work over there. We had an extremely small engineering team, but one of them was the lead mobile developer for Facebook, Luke Shepard. Another one, Alex Koppel, was a big-time developer, well-known in the world beyond eSpark. And Alex basically built an MDM in a couple of months to support the eSpark product, which started out as paper and pen, essentially. Like watch a video, answer some questions. That was the original vision. And it just kind of kept growing and getting more robust to the point where then they had a learning design team. Their job is to spend, 8 hours a day reviewing apps and then correlating them to Common Core standards, which I'm sure you hear a lot about. Common Core standards are, it's hard to even explain. There's so much controversy here. And not a whole lot of nuance to the thinking of how we approach it. eSpark was actually very nuanced in how they approached it and thought, well, there's still value. There's value to any, learning standards that have been researched and well thought out. So eSpark said, well, we'll correlate app usage, or we'll correlate what an app does to specific Common Core standards. And that turned out to be a pretty prescient thought that they had, because they were able to then every student in a class could conceivably be working through a different course of apps over the course of the 6 to 8 months that they're going to be using eSpark that year, and we found that no other MDM could really. I've worked a lot with, especially recently, with AirWatch in particular and Casper, and great people at both. And I know Jamf is a sponsor, so I say this not because of that, but just because it's true. What a great working experience we had with them is they assisted us in building out not only this MDM, but like future integration with them. They were really terrific to deal with. So we basically, I was responsible for going from place to place and making sure they were ready to use eSpark, because as I'm sure you know, a lot of schools are running like a single router in the principal's office that, powers the entire building or gives internet to the entire building. So we had to go in, make sure you could handle it, make sure you had some kind of pipe coming in that was sufficient for us, because we're going to be pushing over the course of a year, over 100 apps to each device. And we need to make sure that's moving smoothly. We want to, if we can, we want to come in and put a caching server in. We want to make sure that, the MDM is completely cloud hosted, but we want to make sure you understand how it works, work with you to design the configuration profiles and fun stuff like that.
So what was your kind of overall experience as you went into lots of different schools? Can you sort of sum up any kind of idea about what did you see as the general state of readiness for that kind of deployment? Did you find schools ready and willing, or did you find any sort of common failings, common oversights, anything that people are generally missing that you would recommend?
Yeah, it's a great question, because they're so different. Every building was so completely different. Mm. And one of the things that I noticed, and I think I've probably used this phrase before, we're in sort of like what I would say kind of a gilded age of network and infrastructure, because it seems great. You hear about, even on Long Island where I am, which is a fairly affluent region, we mm-hmm. hear a lot about the schools where the kids are on the iPads for 70 to 75% of the day, or, test scores are through the roof because they've implemented eSpark or some similar program. Mm-hmm. And that's really wonderful. But that's really the tip of the iceberg. And underneath that is a whole lot of schools that are just not being led. A lot of schools don't, even bigger schools and districts out here, don't have tech directors. They'll have a director of curriculum, technology, and instruction, which is a huge bucket for one person.
Three jobs in one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who have the job title human resources and technology. Well, and I have no, I mean, how would those two things have even, the reason that happened is because they looked around the table and they saw that the human resources guy knew how to restart an iPad, and they said, okay, you're the guy. And that's how that title took place. Yeah. There's just sort of a general lack of attention being paid to IT in general in a lot of schools. Not all. I mean, there are many schools that are doing a great job, but there are also quite a few schools and districts where they either don't have an IT director, have an IT director who's probably not totally up to snuff or prepared for that job.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that quite a bit.
Yeah, and quite often you can find that the person who's carrying that title or that de facto job is in fact just the only teacher who was really interested in computers in the school, having been sort of promoted one half step up from being a classroom teacher, you know. I kind of see there's two schools of thought in this. One is it's important to have somebody who's deeply into technology to understand all the implications of that. But at the same time, other people would argue, well, it's important to have somebody who really cares about education in the classroom in that role, so that they don't end up, you know, whatever they do with technology doesn't cut across what they're trying to do in the classroom. So it's a difficult one to get the right balance and to get the right person with the right mindset in that job.
I agree. And I think part of it, I think there's a very protective nature when it comes to schools bringing in outsiders to do just about anything.
Mm.
There's sort of a sense that it's not always that there's something unique to a school that an IT director from a bank is going to come in and not really have a clear understanding of what the job is and how different it is. I'm sure there's just way more on the instructional and pedagogical side
mm-hmm.
than a lot of people expect, especially if you come in without an education background. So I agree to some extent, but I also think if you need a network up, you need a network engineer or, you know, someone who's properly trained. And I mean most of my education came from doing, and I would never knock people who did that, but I've also, you know, I've got a background as an implementation engineer with a software company, so that helps a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is a tricky one. It kind of affects sort of pro sports to a certain extent as well. Like the people who administer and manage and run and do the finance for these organizations are people who at one time were, you know, teachers or where, mm-hmm. you know, players in the game or whatever. And it's not 100% clear to me that if you were trained as a teacher and you that was what you were interested in and you were that was your career, that you are necessarily equipped to be the finance director of a massive private school district or something like that, just because, you know, you once provided the product that business now provides, you know. And all the way through education, you know, I keep talking about this as like the survivorship bias of education, that the people who run education now are the people who liked going to school. and for people who never liked going to school and didn't succeed in the sort of traditional world of school, they don't get a lot of representation on school boards and, you know, in education departments and governments and so on. So it's a tricky one to get the balance right there, I think.
I think that's one example. You know, you mentioned earlier in the podcast, or actually we were talking before the podcast, and you said there are times when you're giving a speech or you're hearing a speech and you hear something similar, you know, a thought that you had had or something similar to what you had said. I'm fairly certain I borrowed that entire idea from you and gave it a speech about a year ago because I said very similar thing. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting is that in a lot of schools, there's a conflation between interest and talent or ability. So if someone has an interest in something, if someone's interested in technology, that's read as having an ability, you know, having a skill, when there's generally, you know, there's interest and then there's practice and learning and then it becomes a skill. So, I tend to agree that traditionally, we don't hire like finance managers out of the math classroom. Then sometimes we do. I know the president of Zavarian was a math teacher at Zavarian. So, and he was pretty great at his job from what I could tell. So I think that's, it can work both ways. I personally think technology at this point is just a little too vital to the backbone of the building to roll the dice.
Yeah, it's becoming, and I suppose it's good that it is that way. You know, if the technology was sufficiently unimportant that anybody could just do it and it would be fine, that's more of a red flag, I think, than, you know, we lean on it and it's sometimes the person who's doing it doesn't quite get the job that we're trying to do. Let me take a minute to tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Mac, iPad, iPhone and Apple TV in education. And now with Casper Focus, they've placed these great technologies directly into the hands of the teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even start AirPlay right from Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamsoftware.com. So one thing I wanted to ask you, Patrick, you know, having been inside an MDM implementation house, is what's your kind of take on the state of MDM, both from on Apple's platform and also on other platforms? You've talked about your Chromebook experience as well. How do you feel? How well are we being served with that? And are other platforms as powerful as Apple's platform, or are there better things in other places?
Yeah, it's a challenging question. I think I would summarize my entire feeling on this by saying something that kind of breaks my heart to say, which is I would deploy iPads to make things better for my students, but I would deploy Chromebooks to make things better for me, which is the gap between MDM and implementation in general. So Apple's entire system, the Apple ID for Students program, was somewhat disastrous, possibly more than somewhat disastrous, depending on who you talk to, in that schools who had shared device models were being told that they couldn't really use an MDM, or they were stuck with Configurator as their only means of provisioning iPads, which, I mean, that really backed people into a corner, because no one was going to use Configurator. Or at least most schools were interested in not using Configurator. MDMs have become pretty much a necessity in any school deploying iPads in any kind of serious number. So you have AirWatch and Casper and Lightspeed and you know, every other MobileIron and Zen. All these other MDMs are throwing their hats in the ring and trying to help you manage these devices, but at the same time doing what we were doing over at eSpark and saying, we don't have a way for you to generate Apple IDs. If you bought these from a reseller, we can't enroll them in DEP. The restrictions were the implementation programs, other than VPP, were just not very good in my estimation, and they hindered what an MDM could do to make iPads manageable.
Yeah, I mean, we went over to that model of managed distribution for all devices, even for the younger kids. I went through the pain of making a series of device generic Apple IDs over was that last summer? Which is fine for me, because it was like 45 I had to make, you know, but the very hard limit on how well that scales. And also similarly with Configurator, that kind of return to base model isn't going to scale up beyond 100 or so, maybe 200 at the outside. But having gone through that pain, we certainly got a massive increase, or a massive decrease rather, in time out of service for the devices. So it has genuinely been worth it for us, because it was possible for us to brute force it. But, you know, if you're talking about deploying 500 and you don't want to do individual Apple IDs or can't for age reasons or whatever, then, I guess people like that are still waiting for a solution. You know, the Apple ID for student one hasn't really taken off. It kind of got iTunes Radio, didn't it? You know, it launched in the US and then it didn't launch anywhere else, and that's never a good sign, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like the model was pretty clearly geared towards creating future consumers, not necessarily doing anything positive in the market space, which is unfortunate, because I think one of the reasons that a lot of schools, and me as a person, I feel more comfortable with Apple, because I know, you know, and I'm not necessarily saying this negative towards Google. I just know that Apple's trying to sell me expensive devices. Mm-hmm. So I'm more comfortable with them. My students using Apple IDs is not a problem for me. I'm okay with all that. But then when you sort of force our hands and expose the process to us a little bit too nakedly, like, you know, everyone needs an Apple ID because when they turn 13, they can buy. That's not ideal for me. And that wasn't, you know, it wasn't the way I would have rolled out that particular program. But I think they're, you know, there's a lot of scuttlebutt that they're making changes. So
I'm hearing similar rumors that there's certainly going to be changes to the under 13's Apple ID. There's going to be changes to the requirement to have an Apple ID active on the device in order to assign applications to the device and things like that. So I think the next 18 months are going to be quite interesting, and to see how some of that works out.
I think they realize just to touch upon the major competitor, which is the Chromebook. Chromebooks are remarkably easy to manage. You know, generating users is incredibly easy. Whereas with most of the schools we worked with at eSpark, you know, we really weren't in a position where we could generate Apple IDs for anybody. So we'd tell a school, you know, well, there's a script on GitHub, knock yourself out. And they would do that. And then, of course, they'd create 1500 or something, but as they would start getting bulk banned because the IP range was, you know, triggering some sort of issue on the Apple side. So you'd have 1500 Apple IDs that a school created, and 1495 had been disabled before they had gotten a login with them.
Yeah, that can definitely happen. There is there is a mechanism by which you can have your IP address whitelisted on the store, which is fine if you have a contact with the right person who can get that for you, which I fortunately did, but not everybody does, that's for sure.
And a lot of our schools with eSpark were kind of going off without consulting us, at least you know, for that part of the process. So they didn't even necessarily know that there was a mechanism by which they could whitelist IPs, or you know, even better, contact someone from Apple to assist in the creation of, which I don't think has ever worked for anyone, but I always thought was a worthwhile call because it sort of shifts the pain onto them and lets them know that this is a pain point for a lot of schools.
Yeah. I know some resellers in the UK had been taking that pain for themselves. That was their big value add, was that they would sit and make all the Apple IDs for you. But if that's been taken away from them, I don't know what's left.
That would require, you'd have to be handy with a VPN, I guess. You'd have to be shifting IPs for every four IDs you created.
Yeah, there's all kinds of flags on that. And I mean, the other one is just the email domain as well. That if you make enough at cedars.inverclyde.sh.uk Apple IDs, then that's going to get flagged as well. So there's actually multiple different things that you have to, when you get whitelisted, you have to declare your outbound IP. You also have to say, well, what email domain are they going to be made in? What's the pattern going to be? And all this. So there's actually multiple flags, multiple tripwires you can trigger on the Apple ID creation side. And it's pretty tricky.
And a very painful process for just about anyone who tried to go through with it. And anyone who did it legitimately, anyone who tried to do the under 13 Apple ID program legitimately, it requires a 100% response rate, which is unheard of in any field. You know, you need 100% of parents need to authorize that their student can use this Apple ID. And I'm working at Valley Stream 30. That's a district where not every student has internet at home. In fact, you know, there's a significant population that does not. So you're basically shifting the onus onto parents and saying, well, when you get home from work at 7 o'clock tonight, after you feed your children, go find an open library, which doesn't exist because they close at 4. You know, they're just not creating, there's not a lot of ways for people who aren't connected at all times to authorize for their students, authorize their children to have Apple IDs. It's just sort of a clunkily implemented system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the UK, where we don't even have that method, I've heard even official Apple people say things like, oh, well, now what you should do is just use iTunes family sharing. And I was like, well, that implies that the parents also got an iPhone and they've got a working Apple ID and all that kind of stuff.
So, right.
And a credit card for that matter. So, you know, the need for this is just so obvious and so long in the tooth that it will be good if it eventually does come.
You scratch your head a little bit because you think, why would you even give, you know, the only reason that we really started to think about Chromebooks was the expense issue. Mm. But then the secondary issue of the management, especially going into a new district like I am right now, I really do want management to be as smooth and simple as possible. So there's that temptation to do what might on some level be wrong for the students. Not that I'm saying it is. I think Chromebooks are great, but I know for some people they feel like, you know, that's sort of the way out of difficult, challenging management. I don't know if that's true or not, but
yeah, I mean, I think the way I was describing Chromebook, you know, I was talking to a colleague last night, and they were asking me what I was thinking about the Chromebook stuff that I'd been looking at, and I said, look, the thing is that for a school like Cedars, where we've been iOS for 5 years, to then go from that to Chromebook would be in some ways a functional step backwards, whereas somebody coming from, say, nothing or a lab situation to a one-to-one Chromebook deployment, that would be a phenomenal step forward. So I feel like Chromebook, it very much depends where you're coming from and also what your strategy is vis-a-vis things like Google Docs as to whether or not that's going to be a forward step or a backward step, depending on where you're at.
And Microsoft has made it even more confusing for us because if you do, you know, we could now buy Outlook 365 mail licenses that would also give us Office licenses. And now we're choosing between Pages, Numbers, Keynote, Google Docs. You know, so it's really a battle between the attractiveness of the iWork suite and the simplicity and ease of sharing for the Google Docs and the Google Drive suite and Google Apps for Education as a whole. And then, of course, Windows and the Microsoft products that are just so ingrained in people's minds that they're, you know, the warm and comfortable options. So there are a lot of options, and platform is still relatively important, though I don't know how important it'll be in 5 to 10 years, but it's vitally important now.
Yeah, I always think it just depends on what you mean by platform. You know, mm-hmm. If you're going to have a diverse hardware platform and a diverse range of operating systems, you have to then invent another platform that everybody agrees on. You know, and in times past, that was the learning management system, right? So you could, you know, bring anything that could access Moodle, and as long, you know, but Moodle was the platform. And you know, I think as you know, Google Drive and Google Docs, or Office 365, or iCloud, if that ever catches up, that's going to be the platform. And your strategy either is at the operating system level or it's at the document management level. And I think increasingly people are sort of looking, people who want to do bring your own device or whatever, they're looking at some kind of standardized platform above that. And whether that's just the web, or I think on mobile devices, it has to be more than just the web, because the web and mobile still really isn't what it needs to be. Mm-hmm. I think there's always going to be a common platform. The question is just, is it device level or is it one level above that in the stack?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Cool. So let's think about Chromebook deployments. You know, you were talking about having experience of doing some large Chromebook deployments in a kind of shared model. Do you have any kind of specific thoughts on that? I mean, there will be people listening who are thinking about or have even been tasked with doing something like that over the summer. Are there any specific recommendations you would pull out of your experience for doing Chromebook in that way?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is, and this is, I sometimes regret having this feeling, but it's the truth. I think if I had a choice between 2-to-1 iPads or 1-to-1 Chromebooks, I would go with the Chromebooks. Mm-hmm. Because I think the more important thing is the ratio right now, rather than the device. I think the iPad is the best device for transformative learning in a classroom. But I think if you need to get devices and you don't have that kind of money, I would go 1-to-1 Chromebook in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. So my first piece of advice is don't hesitate. If you're considering a Chromebook deployment, iPads are not a fiscal reality. I think it's a great way to go. Learn the Dash. You know, immerse yourself in the admin Dash. It's incredible. It's intuitive. It's easy. Just understand that the management piece is going to be a lot simpler than you might expect. I would also make sure, and one of the big mistakes I think a lot of schools make is they go Google Apps for Education or they go Chromebook, and there's not a whole lot of scaffolding for the staff. There's philosophically, I think there's two trains of thought. I've heard principals say, not anyone I work with now, but I've heard in the past principals say, well, the kids don't ask for professional development. They just pick them up and figure it out, which is a nice thing, you know, philosophically to say, but I don't know that it necessarily has any bearing on reality. You know, teachers' reality is that they have to design impactful lessons and meet certain standards. So I think they need extensive training. Teach people, understand that not everyone's using Google Apps for Education or Google Docs or any of that stuff. I think the key to managing anything well is just really understanding what you're doing, and that Chrome is a web OS. It's very different from what you might anticipate. I'm sort of interested in the possibility. And I'd be curious as to your thoughts on this. We're mm-hmm. a K-6 district. I'm sort of interested in the possibility of, we have a lot of iPads already. I've thought a lot about K-4 iPads and then 5 and 6 Chromebooks. And the primary reason is, you know, the mixed modalities, that's great. But it's also because our kids are leaving our district and going into a central district that doesn't have, you know, any kind of, not even a 2-to-1 program. You know, it's still devices in labs. So yeah. The technology piece is very much siloed. So I thought it would be great to give these kids the opportunity to experience two different, you know, vastly different platforms and vastly different ways of interacting with devices before they aren't really working on devices on a regular basis. And I'm curious as if you've seen a model like that work, or if you've, you know, overseen implementation of a model like that.
Mm-hmm. I haven't done one myself, but I've certainly seen that kind of model where it's iPad from the early years up to a certain point, and then it's some kind of laptop-like thing, whether Chromebook or even Macs or Windows PCs beyond that. And sometimes that's because the school that is doing this has, you know, they've traditionally had a laptop program for the senior years, and they're bringing iPad into the years that never had anything. Or they're making the same kind of argument you're making. I haven't seen it done myself at such an early stage, doing that cut over to a different kind of device. But I think there's it's an area that I think people are becoming more concerned about, particularly when you have a situation where a student's in your domain for a while and then they're going to somewhere else that is under a very different regime. How do we manage that transition between those two worlds? And can we even manage it? Is that gap even bridgeable in the world where you've got a rich technology program in the early years, and then how do those children cope when they go to another world? And I see that already. Like, I gave my daughter one of my Chromebooks recently, and I saw her struggle to log into it. And the reason she struggled to log into it was because she didn't know how to type the @ sign because it was a shifted character.
Right.
And she had no idea how to use the shift key. And it's not because she didn't understand the concept of there being alternate characters, but on iOS, where she's lived her whole life, whenever the whatever key is on the keycap that you see, that's what you get when you type it. Whereas she didn't understand the concept and didn't even have the sequence of cording two keys together to get a shifted character. I thought that was just something that brought back to mind that whole question to me.
It's quite an abstract philosophy when you actually look at a keyboard after you've typed on iOS for a while. You know, using that, the iOS keyboard, it's not particularly intuitive. I mean, to paste text into the format that you want it, to keep the format of the document, it's like Shift Control Option Command V. I mean, those are not things that would automatically occur to someone to do. So I totally understand that's sort of the gap that worries me is that, and the other thing is, I don't know how long iPads are going to be a popular education solution. There's just a finite shelf life on so many things. You wonder, as the iPad Pro comes into play, that sounds more like, it sounds like some of the Apple offerings have gotten a little bit more convoluted than they have been in the past. So there'll be an iPad Pro that, in some sense, takes the place of, I guess, smaller iPads, but probably won't be very useful for education. You have the MacBook Air, which seems to be potentially being phased out in favor of the MacBook, which is, to me, an iPad with a keyboard, at least at this stage. Mm-hmm. It's challenging to make a decision today that you think will be the right one 3 to 5 years down the line, I think, because the iPad is just mature enough to make that tricky.
Yeah, I mean, unquestionably, I think that conversation has gotten more difficult rather than less difficult. And, you know, the Apple lineup now lacks that sort of Jobsian simplicity of you know, 5, 10 years ago. I mean, you think what you've got, like you said, you've got MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, iPad, iPad Air 2, iPad Air 2, 3 versions of the Mini, some of which have different kinds of radios than others. I mean, these are kind of things that are really not obvious, right? There was a while where you could buy the iPad 2, which didn't support AirDrop, for example, I feel really bad. I mean, every time Apple rev their line, Bradley and I do a show about which iPad you should buy this year. And I think that's getting a harder show to do because the answers are more difficult. And of course, then what happens with this iPad Pro that's supposed to be coming out? My concern is that takes, you know, that becomes a device that is the really powerful iPad, but it starts to drift into Microsoft Surface Pro 3 pricing territory, you know, and it takes it really out of the range of schools to afford a device like that. So it'll be interesting to see. That's probably my most, the thing I really care most about when it comes to this supposed iPad Pro is what price is that thing going to be? Mm-hmm. And is it even in the ballpark for schools or not? And that will be something that's worth keeping an eye on, I think.
And ironically, even though there are a million Chromebooks out there, the choice is sort of presented as a binary. And that makes things easy for people. It's either, so you're saying we're either going to get a Chromebook that's roughly $250 per student, or we're going to get an iPad that could range from $490 to $1,200, depending on what this Pro comes in at. So I think that actually makes it easier to say, let's do Chrome. The other thing about Chromebooks is there's something more disposable about them. Even though iPads iterate frequently, there's a general sense that something that costs under $300 is something that you can throw away when the time comes, and something that costs $600-$700, which the iPads we would want to use would cost. It's a lot more difficult to break up with something that, you know, costs twice as much as the cheaper alternative, and that's why I think the Chromebooks may be useful for us at 5 and 6. They bridge the gap to 1-to-1 as well. I mean, right now it's I'm not sure what the situation is in Europe. I listen to really only you guys as far as podcasts go, education wise. So I know specifically your circumstances, but there's something of a race to 1-to-1 out here now in New York, and I guess in a lot of the big, I mean, you saw it in LA.
Yeah.
You saw it blow up spectacularly in LA. Mm-hmm. But there's really this sort of race to get one-to-one, and I think there are a lot of poor underlying assumptions that are leading to that race. But in our case, it's more because I feel anxious that this two-to-one models just don't work particularly well, in my estimation. They're a bridge to a one-to-one model. Right now, we're going to be two-to-one for a while. So if it Chromebooks, you know, if it takes Chromebooks to get us one-to-one, and we can do that in the span of a year, I'd certainly be inclined to look at that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you describe it to me as, you know, 2-to-1 is just not the model that society uses for computers and work.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right. I've never gone into an office and sat next to somebody and passed them my computer after an hour of working, or been told, you know, we have a big project coming up. Why don't you and Joe sit at the same computer and work on it together?
Yeah, the only place you do that is paired programming, and that drives people insane.
Right? Yeah, that's how people end up killing other people. So the notion that there's some sort of like natural shared device model, or that it's teaching collaboration, I think it might teach the opposite of collaboration, because it would make me insane to have to share the device I was working on with someone else.
I think that whole idea of shared devices teach collaboration and turn-taking is very much retconning onto an economic reality, some, you know, basically bogus pedagogical justification. I've never bought that as a thing that, you know, like, do we have, you know, half the number of desks so we can take turns in the chair, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, why don't we give, you know, 15 notebooks for 30 kids and let them sort it out? If that's such a, you know, if there's so many positive benefits to letting kids deal with that stuff, we could do it in a lot of other ways. We could have less bathrooms.
Well, you know, the only thing that there's actually a formal ratio for in education is the number of toilets to the number of students.
Well, it's a pretty important number in my experience.
Yes, well, you know, if you get half of them out of action, things go south pretty quickly. So, yeah, shared deployments, you know, you talk about shared assigned as being a really important way to try and get the ownership going there. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, one of the things that we saw at eSpark happen a few times was that we'd have a school that wanted any student to be able to pick up any iPad and do anything on it, which is lofty aspiration. And when you think about how licenses are allocated to devices or to users, depending on how you want to approach that, it's really not a very good method, because you're now costing yourself a license on every device through eSpark. So eSpark would work. Student would sign into eSpark on the device. We query our MDM, say, what apps does this student need to work on for this mission and quest? MDM pushes those apps out to the device, provided they've already been purchased in the BPP store at some point. So when a student picks up 10 devices, we're pushing that app to each of the devices, but it is consuming a license, because the complexities of the user association are such that each time, you know, you could have one kid signing into 10 devices, 10 licenses are going to be consumed through eSpark, because that's just how it works for us. And it was not a great solution. You know, so we started really pushing people in the direction of shared assigned. And I think that's important for Chromebooks too, for a number of reasons. One, it saves money. If you can pair kids up who have similar pathways, you can buy this, you know, one app one time. And not have to buy 30 licenses for the same app. And that kind of holds on iPads or Chromebooks. But the other thing is, it's very difficult to track. It's very difficult to understand who did what to a device, if any student can pick up any device. Like the practical reality of doing that, I couldn't possibly understand how you might foster that sense of ownership that you hear so much about in students when they have a device, if you're shared but not assigned. And the other thing is, you know, students do inappropriate things. It's, you know, 20% of what an IT director's job is trying to figure out what inappropriate things a student is going to figure to do.
And keeping on top of the new innovations in that area as well.
Yeah, so and sweating out Snapchat when you realize it's taking foot in your school. So the notion that, you know, any student can pick up any device means anything could happen, and people say, well, they'll be signed in, so we'll know. But that's, you know, that's not an ideal solution, because a student can pick something up, not sign in, and do whatever they want to it, sign in under other students' names. We'd really rather have sort of this feeling of ownership on the device, that this is yours. If something happens to it, it's, you know, it's yours, and you're sharing it with one, two, or three other people, but you're still a big part of the device's ownership history.
Mm-hmm. I was advocating this whole area to a visitor who came to the school this week, and she was a newly qualified teacher. She just finished her 4-year degree in teaching. And I asked her, I said, you know, so where did you study? And she named one of the teacher training colleges in Scotland, who I will not name for the sake of politics. And I said, well, so how much sort of ed tech training did you get in your 4-year degree? And she said, oh, none at all. I was like, okay, well, you know, suddenly people wonder why iPad deployments fail.
And you know why that is? Because no one can teach it. Because because these programs, I mean, we could talk about this for 3 hours, but the people who are teaching in these programs are so thoroughly entrenched. There's such a desire to not change anything.
Mm.
Every stakeholder in this process, except for the students, has a vested interest in not changing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what it feels like sometimes. So the people at Teachers College or whatever school, you know, that you're attending, there's a very good likelihood they haven't taught young children on a regular basis in decades. So to ask them to assess the value of an iPad deployment when they've never been a part of one and are, you know, in the abstract, you can read the research, you can get, you know, Fleischer's study and William Penuel's study, you could read through those, the meta studies, and find out a lot. But if you're not overseeing it, being a part of it, or even just in a classroom on a regular basis to understand why other things haven't worked, I just think I think it feeds itself, and it's the greatest interest that the entire system has is stasis, just to remain as it is and as it, you know, try to protect what everyone has,
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, being progressive.
Again, the people who run education, the people who liked it the way it was when they were there.
Exactly. School worked for them.
I mean, that probationer teacher that I mentioned, she is in fact being given responsibility for her school's iPad deployment.
That's a terrible punchline.
And 26 six-year-old children for the first time in her career as well. So may God be with her, I think, is all we can say to that.
I can never understand how you could ask anyone to manage an iPad deployment and then do other stuff, because it's a lot of work to manage an iPad deployment.
Yeah, you have to really get good with the automation tools. You know, I think mm-hmm. in the past couple of years, I mean, I teach several different gear groups in the school and run the whole IT program as well. And the only way I'm doing that now is because of the tools, the MDM tools and the volume purchase program and things like that. Without those tools, I would be going out of my mind trying to keep on top of what's going on. But I've got my Snapchat early warning system set up in Casper and things like that. So I can clamp down on that pretty quickly if I have to. So these are the kind of tools. And unless you've been brought up or trained at some level, or even you're just self-taught at some level in the systems administration topics and considerations like that, you don't even know what you don't know in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the difficulty of it.
I couldn't tell you how many schools were, and this seems like one of the craziest decisions that you could possibly make. Many schools are using provisioning profiles for restrictions, you know, to block websites. So they're creating whitelists and blacklists inside their configurator profiles there. And that's just a terrible idea if you have a filter. You know, I would hope that you had a filter installed at the network level that was going to take care of 90% of that. And if you, because those on-device restrictions cause all sorts of other issues. This is another area where iPads are frustrating. We learned sometime in February or March over at eSpark that at some point a code change was made so that the restrictions, the restrictions on TV, movies, instead of each one being able to be set individually, it still shows that you can do that, but they're going to default to the most restrictive setting no matter what you put. We had no idea this was the case, and we also, you know, the App Store, it can be somewhat random in what, you know, like for instance, Chrome, I think, is, or at least it was 17 plus because you could access adult content through it. So all of a sudden now you can't, people are wondering, why can't I get Chrome on these iPads? And you say, well, for some reason, you know, this change has happened, so the age banding in configurator no longer matters. It's only going to take your most restrictive setting. So if you said only G-rated movies, it's going to read that as 200, I believe, is the numerical. So it's that it's going to be a 200. Even if you set your television at 800, your movies are going to be a 200, yeah. And that's what everything on the device is going to be.
Yeah.
And so when you don't know that network filters exist, or you don't know how to configure one, or you lack that basic understanding of device deployment prior to iPads, it's going to be an extremely difficult road to hoe when you come in and are now being asked to manage these somewhat complex new devices.
Yeah, I think the phrase I've used is that iOS deployment has kind of become professionalized. You know, that mm-hmm. 5 years ago, it used to be a thing where you were basically doing the same thing to one device for yourself that you did to 100 devices. And I was using the same technology at home and at school, plugging it into iTunes and syncing it, because that's all there was.
Right.
And today, the personal experience is I sign in on iCloud my device and it just lives. Whereas the experience at school is incredibly complex in terms of things like, activation lock, how to deal with that, how to deal with people signing out of one Apple ID and into another Apple ID and downloading something and locking their device. And there's in my opinion, there's too many kind of hidden tripwires in iOS that you can fall over in a way that's difficult to recover from. I even had that experience just today where a student who's leaving school tomorrow, her parents had bought her a new iPad, and they had tried to restore it from her iCloud backup, but it had taken along the supervision profile with the backup. Now, that never used to happen, but apparently now it does. And it had also taken over the restriction PIN code that I had set like 2 years ago and forgotten I'd ever done it. And so her mum's on the phone asking me, what's the PIN code that you set on her device? And I'm thinking, we don't use a PIN code. We've got numeric passcodes. And then eventually she brought it to the school and I looked at it and I realized at what stage it was asking for this code. And okay, now I understand that that's the code we're talking about, because she's, this parent's confusing supervision as an issue with the fact that there's a restrictions PIN code as well. And then I'm thinking, well, what about the passcode? Is that, and there's so many of these kind of moving parts. And I'm starting to lose my mind about some of it as well. And I think, a little more transparency into what is going on in the background with some of that stuff would be very welcome.
Yeah, we found out very, very recently. I guess, again, this was probably somewhere. March was a rough month. We found out that that something changed about the install method for purchased versus free apps, or non-paid apps, however you want to phrase that. And that change meant that eSpark could, for at least a little while, no longer install purchased apps, which is the vast majority of our library. So engineers just sleepless nights staying up trying to figure out what exactly changed. And then we got notice of it. I think we had gotten notice that there was going to be a change. But generally, I think the MDM vendors are getting pretty short notice. It's not, 6 months of lead time to build out an infrastructure that can support, or a code base change that can support whatever is coming. It just sort of happens. And then There's a lot of reverse engineering to figure out what we can do to make it unhappen.
I kind of wonder why these things are happening in such short notice. And I slightly suspect, although I have no actual evidence of this, but I suspect that some of it is, we found a massive security hole, let's just shut it as soon as we can, screw whatever happens to people. It's just, let's close that door as soon as we can to protect ourselves.
Now, my assumption, too, is that I couldn't tell you exactly what, but the nature of the change made me feel like someone had figured out how to get either purchase apps for free. That was what jumped out in my mind, was the only reason you break installation of apps in this way is because you're trying to protect, a pile of money somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, that was the motivation behind the, your Apple ID is, your device is locked to a specific Apple ID for 90 days after you download something from your purchase history, was because some of the big one-to-one programs in the US, the kids were logging out of their Apple ID, logging into their friend's device on their Apple ID, downloading all their apps for their friends, and then signing back out again. And basically there was a big piracy rings going on in some of the bigger high schools that had one-to-one programs. And so that was the beginning of the 90-day restriction in terms of logging into somebody else's Apple ID on your device and downloading stuff.
And yet the enormous, if anyone was so inclined, it would be pretty easy to just take the IPA file out of iTunes, dump it into whatever you want, whatever folder you want, and let someone else install all their IPAs that way.
Yep.
So it's not, they fixed the easy part of it, but there's still quite a few ways to get free apps if someone was so inclined.
Let me tell you about Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, Teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps, or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobi Basic is completely free, and teachers can try it out with their students in just a few minutes. Get started by downloading Shobi on the App Store or by visiting shobi.com. Shobi is also offering a special deal for school admins listening to this podcast. Buy Shobi Pro for 5-year teachers, and they'll upgrade an extra 5 teachers to Shobi Pro for free. That's a total of 10 teachers and all their students on Shobi Pro for a full year. Visit shobi.com/outofschool for details. Tell me about anything else you're interested in, Patrick. I mean, what's kind of on your mind in terms of edtech?
The stuff that I tend to ping you about or I talk to you on Twitter about is the incredibly slow process of change in education. And having come from working at an education technology company like eSpark, where change is the order of the day. Mm-hmm. We literally transitioned from HipChat to Slack in probably 2 days. And it was just basically one email to the entire company saying, you can stay on HipChat, but you'll be alone. We're all going to be on Slack. And that's how change happens at a startup. There's not a whole lot of, you know, there's not consensus building. It's sort of like someone has a good idea, 2 or 3 people support it, and then things happen. In education, it's just so completely the opposite. And I think some of it might be a reaction, especially in America, and I'm curious as to if this is happening in other places, but there's a kind of a pushback against data in general, just the idea of using it to do anything. And in the States, we've made this correlation between data-driven instruction and government-driven curriculum. That seems to be the connection that's been made. Bill Gates and other, you know, rich plutocrats are telling us that this is how we should teach because that's what the data is telling them, and people sort of resent the use of data, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, the whole child and holistic education. I guess I'm curious as to A, if that's going on the same in Europe as it is here, the slow pace and the pushback, and B, what do we do? What are our coping strategies?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this could be a whole podcast in itself, you know, for in perpetuity is what about data and education? Certainly in Scotland, what has happened with the curriculum that's been brought in over the past 10 years is that there are many, many fewer points in this curriculum where you actually measure in a formal way. So we used to have a series of national tests that were done at levels A through E, I think it was. I never did them because that was below the level that I taught at, but also before my time. And those would be, you know, those were standardized tests and they were measured and they were scored. And you could say, well, you've passed level A, you've passed level B and so on. And you're supposed to pass these levels at specific ages. Whereas now, there's not really a formalized national system of assessments in any way at any stage until you get to, 10th, 11th grade equivalent in the US, where you sit in exams called nationals and then highers and then advanced highers. And that's when you get graded on a number. And I think some people might be having a little bit of a surprise at that point to see what is going on. So there's not really a pushback against data. Well, maybe the pushback happened a number of years ago, but there's no data to push back on is really the problem. there was a big political fuss a few months ago because there is a thing called the Scottish Survey of Literacy and Numeracy where they sample a number of pupils from a number of schools and they do literacy and numeracy tests with them and they see, you know, how well are we doing in terms of those particular two areas, those are kind of enthroned as the two areas of the curriculum that are everybody's problem, literacy and numeracy. So as a computer science teacher, I would maybe deal with numeracy in respect of, converting from decimal to binary or, you know, powers of two or something like that, the kind of bits of numeracy that are mine. And what happened was that they found that we had gone backwards 5% as a result of the changes that have come in. So it's kind of interesting because you take a curriculum that doesn't have any national standards, I mean, it basically says nothing about performance standards at all, and then apply a national performance standard and people are surprised that it went backwards because, you know, how could we have known where we were in that respect because we didn't have a national standard? So the pushback against data is, I certainly see it. I see it in the US from what I look at, you know, people, it's perceived as people coming from outside education, telling educators how to do their job. And that never goes down well, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's Bill Gates coming in with data or Apple coming in with iPads or, you know, Google coming in with, you know, Google Classroom or whatever. Teachers don't like to be told what to do. That seems to be a worldwide constant.
That is definitely a worldwide constant. Nothing can happen at a school unilaterally. There's just no hope of that happening.
You know, I say teachers don't like to be told what to do, but then if you know, as we have done in Scotland, the government doesn't sort of exactly tell you what to do, that's also a riot as well. So I guess teachers just like to complain both ways.
Well, teachers here definitely don't get a choice. We're testing more or less out of the womb at this point, and right up through high school, you will be tested and tested and tested again. And now I think that a lot of the fight is that the way that we're using data is as a cudgel to sort of beat teachers who are not doing what we want into a line. And that's probably why there's so much resentment. It's unfortunate, though, because it's so strange to me to come from, you know, like I think eSpark spent more on student research in a month than any school or district I've ever worked at spent in its entirety, in the entirety of its lifespan, because data and figuring out how to best improve student outcomes was, and I say this with the understanding it's kind of an American viewpoint in a negative way, and I'm certainly not, you know, super capitalist, but there is a sense that eSpark had a profit motive. If students didn't succeed, eSpark goes out of business. It's a very simple formula. So eSpark has to make sure students succeed. Schools are big and monolithic, and they will not go out of business in most cases. And not that you want them to, but the way that we've sort of done things now is that we test, we tie every test to teacher observations. So teachers, you really basically have to show improvement for your students in order to be rated as an effective teacher. And that doesn't really take into account anything, you know, changes in your student population that occur. Students who come in without testing, how do they impact your reviews? Or it's become, people are probably seeing data being used against them in a really negative way. So I think that's got a lot to do with it. I don't blame teachers for feeling a little bit put upon by the level of testing. But this is what accountability has sort of come to mean in American education, is just testing. So that there isn't an easy solution to it. It sounds like Xanadu in Scotland, if you're being tested starting from the 10th grade, that sounds wonderful. we're marching like, you know, crying third graders into these testing rooms. And the anxiety is palpable, not only among the teachers, but also, of course, the kids and the parents. Because schools are getting shut down, but not necessarily for the right reasons. Schools are being shut down for a lot of the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and I think that the more that teachers and administrators are under pressure from the results of those kind of things, the more that will feed into the students as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the students, I'm sure in some cases, the students are very well aware of the consequences of failure. You know, it's not just, you know, that I might not personally do very well, but also that my school might get shut down. You know, and I think, well, you know, when we did have national tests, they were useful and they were used, but they were not ever necessarily used as like determinants of whether or not the school was successful. I mean, you might get a mention that says, well, your national test results are not as good as a comparator school in some other district, and that would be a reason for improvement or something like that. But it wasn't necessarily, in fact, I don't think it was ever tied to like the level of funding that your school might get, for example.
Well, a lot of it here, I think another piece of the controversy is that there's also, so the Common Core sort of sprung up at either a convenient or a suspicious time, because there's been such a push towards the privatization of education in the United States, and the charter schools popping up everywhere. And one of the big controversies just a couple of weeks ago is that there was a charter school where the kids were experiencing depression and anxiety due to the testing, because they were apparently being told, you won't get to continue coming here if you don't test well. So that's how the charter school is keeping the, you know, and that's of course a pretty grave threat to a fourth grader. So the charter school was sort of, because the charter school will be defunded and shut down. if they don't hit certain metrics. We're very much into assessing in the moment, but making changes over the long term. So it's a very strange push and pull we have going on. We're not really open to, like, there's no planned, there's a lot of recommendations, like SETDA made the recommendation every school should have 100 megs per student by whatever it was, 2016-17. And it's nice that they go out there, but then there's not a lot of follow through on the initiatives. No Child Left Behind was another initiative. It was, you know, unfunded initiatives are not really going to go anywhere. There's a lot of moving around of furniture, but not so much actual progress or change. And,
yeah, I sometimes describe it as there's a lot of upheaval, but not very much change.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
You know, I kind of feel that we're a wee bit like that in Scotland, where we've been through a massive transformation in terms of the style of writing in the curriculum and many of the outcomes in the curriculum as well. But at the same time, the structure of education hasn't been tampered with in any way. You know, it's still the same number of years in primary. You start at the same age, you transition at this point, you do this number of years, you sit your exams at the same points, and then you sit exactly the same kinds of exams at the same points with, you know, the practical versus exam boundary shifted plus or minus 5% for them to take account of the new curriculum. And then, you know, you go to university or don't, or don't, being the most common outcome for most people. But there's been, you know, mass millions of pounds invested in this, and, you know, years of teachers' careers to get to essentially a slightly different result at the end of the day, and maybe not even that much of a different result after all. So lots and lots of change, lots of worry, lots of stress, lots of new resources, lots of new textbooks, lots of meetings, lots of paperwork. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're still doing 7 years of primary education, 6 years of secondary with three exam years at the end, and then those exams determine your university entry. And that's the way it's been since my parents were at school, more or less. It's just that you need, you know, five or six times the number of exam passes now that my parents ever needed to go to the same universities.
And yet, with all the rearranging of furniture, the literal rearranging of furniture doesn't seem to be a priority. You know, going in and redefining how a classroom looks and the space that students are learning in, it seems like we're awfully content. I mean, I still see so many schools with the kids organized in the factory grid. It sort of boggles the mind that we're pushing to all these different outcomes without actually doing anything instructionally that inspires a functional change, rather than, you know, a change that we put in a booklet, give to teachers, and say, this is how we're going to teach math now. That's great, and I, you know, it works. But for the most part, the stuff that would probably have a serious impact on even how a child approaches school psychologically, like, you know, I'm particularly not a fan of smart boards or interactive whiteboards in general, because they're essentially PowerPoint projectors in most classrooms. They're just a way to show more slides and do less. You know, it's a way to call up a YouTube video and make the kids sit through a 30-second ad before you show them a 2-minute clip of the Ten Commandments or whatever it is. So I'm really not a fan of the smart board as a center of instruction, and I'm not sure why so many classrooms are still arranged in a model that made sense when people were going off to work in factories. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense now. We just haven't addressed a lot of the fundamental pieces that need to be changed. We're educating children in an environment, in many cases, that teaches them to, you know, look to the front to be instructed and to sit, and being quiet is still kind of paramount in a lot of classrooms. You know, a quiet room is, I remember being told by one of my first bosses in a school, he said, if I don't have to come by until December, you're having a good year. And, you know, in retrospect, I look back on that and think, well, that's really depressing. You know, basically, if it was quiet enough and no one complained about me, he wouldn't know I existed, and that would be a great outcome. So you can bet I did my level best to blend in and keep those kids in line. And by keeping those kids in line, I was raising my voice, and I'm instructing by writing 1,000 notes on the board, because my job was to keep them busy and quiet. And if I did well at that, I would probably get a chance to teach an older grade. And if I did well at that, eventually, you know, move up the chain. And that's more or less what happened. I was really good at keeping kids really quiet until I realized that was a horrible skill to be in possession of.
Yeah, I mean, that works for a certain 10 to 15% of your class, probably, who absolutely, and those are the 10 to 15% that are probably school administrators now, like we've been saying, but you know, that's how it goes. Let me tell you about XMA. This episode is sponsored by XMA and the HP Chromebook 11 and 14. Chromebooks have instant on, security built in, long battery life, the best of Google, and access to thousands of educator-approved apps in the Chrome Web Store. XMA brings over 30 years' experience in the UK education market to their All Learn program, a proven framework for deploying devices in education that covers everything from planning, cultural impact, and finance options to infrastructure and management. Working with XMA as an HP partner means you get a choice of great Chromebook devices and all the support you need directly from XMA. Visit xma.co.uk or follow them on Twitter at WeAreXMA. Thanks to XMA and HP for sponsoring this show. So what do you think about in terms of, you're talking about the possibilities for new spaces in the school. Have you seen anything in your travels that really inspired you, that you thought was a really forward-thinking way to put together a learning space?
Yeah, I've seen a few things that I thought were really, really cool, but I guess I'm still, this is something I'm trying to work out in my head right now, because our classroom technology in Valley Stream is good, probably better than the vast majority of schools have, but I think it's very confusing that we have all these single purpose pieces of tech. You know, we have a couple of smart tables, which I don't really get. We have, you know, document cameras, and we have the Eno boards, Eno pens, document cameras, still overhead projectors in some rooms, FM systems, response, you know, clicker response systems. I feel like I'd like to just get rid of the vast majority of single serve technical applications and replace them with one device for each student. That's how a student can respond to things. Now, what I've seen that I really liked was not necessarily the classroom spaces. At Xaverian, they were turning a couple of classrooms into a STEM lab, and the STEM lab was, you know, makerspace or whatever phrase or word you want to use. They're all kind of cliched sounding at this point, but the STEM lab was really coming along to be an awesome space for the kids. 3D printer off to the corner of the room that, you know, with a couple of computers there, so students could work on that. Then the ability to pull down a green screen so you could film something if you wanted to. I feel like the modal spaces, versatile spaces, spaces that aren't necessarily purely designed for whole group instruction. Since so many schools and so much pedagogy has gotten away from whole group instruction anyway, I'd love to see more flexible spaces. I saw one classroom, I want to say this was in Beaver Creek, Ohio, but it's hard for me to keep them all straight, so I apologize if I'm wrong. I did see one classroom with, in the back of the room, by the reading area, there was a couch, and the couch had like a little table in front. It looked so civilized, Fraser. Like, I went in there and I thought, I want to sit on this couch and read a book and be immersed in this room. And they had a instead of a smart board, an Apple TV in the corner of the room, not dead center front of the room, corner of the room, which gives you the sense that, okay, that's something we use sometimes, but it's not the center of instruction. Each individual is the center of instruction. I forget what the rest of the room really looked like. I remember the couch in the reading corner, the Apple TV and television in the corner to the left of that. And then there were desks, and there were also like regular chairs along one of the walls, which I thought was another really cool thing. Because desks, I mean, if you are a one-to-one school, you could certainly look into thinking about tables or moving away from, you know, moving into like circular tables that seat four or five people at a time. I think all of that's really exciting, but just getting away from, again, you know, getting away from a classroom that does not resemble anything anyone will encounter in real life. I think that's really the thing that gets me the most excited. There's a guy named Don Orth. He's an Apple Distinguished Educator. He's done some great work on this.
I actually visited his school.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. It's in Silicon Valley, or the school he was at. He's no longer there. And he had this cool thing where they had a room where the idea was that every time the class finished, they had to clear the entire room, and the tables flipped up and they could be stacked together, and the chairs would all stack together. And the rule was that every class had to finish the room, or finish their time in the room, looking the same way as it was when they came in, which was all the tables out the way and all the chairs stacked up. And then every class that came in would have to make up the room in the way that they wanted it for what it was they were going to do that day. And that idea has never left me. And if I had a budget to buy those kind of desks, I would have them in a heartbeat, because I think that is a fantastic idea.
I love that. But do they do a? They must do some sort of block scheduling, right? They couldn't be doing that for 40-minute periods.
Yeah, that was a specific room in the school, and I think it wasn't anybody's regular classroom, but it was a space where teachers could take their class to do things. And I don't know what those things necessarily were. I don't think it wasn't specific for any particular subject, I don't think. But they had, you know, whiteboard all around the walls and things like that. And also these movable tables and chairs that could all be put right out of the way just to the edges of the room. Or they could be laid out just like a traditional classroom or a conference room table, different things like that. They just fitted together in many, many different ways that were all really useful.
I'm probably now going to have to send him an email asking him about this, because that sounds exactly like what's in my head, but very hard to elucidate, which is just a space that can be anything for anyone. And I think if you could probably make that work on a classroom-to-classroom basis if the periods were long enough.
Yeah, I mean, our periods are 50 minutes, 55 minutes, so that would be kind of tricky to do that. You'd probably lose about 10 minutes per hour.
I'm thinking like you'd have to start with a block, like a basic block period of 75 minutes maybe, and that might make it worth your while. Block scheduling is another thing that makes all of these decisions challenging, because I've heard a lot of schools looking at that. And that, again, really changes what you want to do with your space, because at least in my estimation, you couldn't possibly expect people to sit for an hour and a half, you know, especially young people to sit for an hour and a half in that grid staring at a screen. I would hope not, anyway.
Yeah, we certainly try and avoid scheduling younger classes in more than 1 hour at a time. The older kids, teachers often want double periods because they want to do science experiments, for example, mm-hmm. or the longer assessments that kids at that stage will sit. They want to have opportunities during the year to do one of those full-length assessments to simulate what they'll be like when they go into their exam situation. So the older kids do get those double blocks, but not always. We try and avoid deliberately the younger classes in secondary getting that kind of experience.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So anything else you want to talk about, Patrick? I think that we've covered a whole range of areas there, waded into some controversy as well that we'll probably get some email about, no doubt. I look forward to it.
We'll both have emails from different folks we know at Apple, I'm sure, when this goes on. Well, I guess my next question is, or my last question is really, when does the Fraser Spears book on this stuff come out? Because I think it's probably getting to be time.
Yeah, well, you know, tomorrow marks the end of 5 years of a one-to-one iPad at Cedars. And I guess I was reflecting on that whole thing today and realizing that, you know, between what we did at Cedars and also my experience of going and talking to other schools, that it's much more about control than about money, I really think. You know, and money is a necessary but not sufficient condition for success, I think, is probably the experience that I've had going to schools where I've been to very poor schools in very poor areas and indeed in poor countries who have done successful deployments and been to some of the richest schools in the world. Who have not been able to get it done. And it's been fascinating to me to realize that it's simply not a case of if you can afford the iPad, you will have a successful deployment. It's not even close to that consideration. So, yeah, maybe that's my summer project, is writing the book about it. I should probably write the history of it before I forget it. You know, even if I'm not going to necessarily publish it right now, I should probably write down what's happened so far.
I was able to basically take notes that I had made over the course of like 18 months and just put them in some kind of order and put them out. And I'm thrilled I did, because it was, I mean, A, it's a nice lever to have. It's nice to have that out there in the world. And it gets people to have some understanding of who you are, which I don't think is a problem for you, but it was definitely helpful for me. But the other thing is so much of it is now useless information. Our book came out in 2013. If you tried to do a deployment paint by numbers the way we laid it out, you really would be out of luck. So I would love a more timeless, that's a strange word for this, but I'd like something that was a little bit more timeless rather than focused on being timely. I'd like to read like more of a narrative. You know, here's a person who starts from point A, which is, you know, the idea for the first one-to-one school. And I'd love to read it more like the hero's journey than just a purely instructional text. There's plenty of those instructional texts out there. I roll one of them, they're fine, but their value over time is nil. So that's what I would love to read, a proper narrative that sort of walked through. It doesn't necessarily have to be the story of one-to-one. It can really be the story of changing student outcomes with a vision. You know, it's just that the one-to-one is the hat you hang on it.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll stick that into OmniFocus and see where I get.
I've given you something to do. And I have one real last question. So mm-hmm. if you wake up tomorrow, you've been offered a job at, you know, head of Scotland Public Schools. You're the director of the entire
deal. Oh, my goodness.
And one of the first orders of business is we need a K-6 one-to-one program, a nationwide mm-hmm. K-6 one-to-one program. Fraser, we need you to pick the device by midnight tonight. What device are you picking?
Wow.
With the understanding that special education students in certain constituencies could, of course, get, you know, other resources. We're just saying one size fits all device for these schools in Scotland, K-6. Let's stick with K-6 just to make it manageable.
Yeah, I think at that stage, you've got to go iPad. Mm-hmm. And I think 30% of the reason is that that constituency are probably already quite familiar with that technology. You know, and we've seen this change over 5 years, where in 2010, we were the first people ever to put an iOS device in the hands of those children. Whereas today, our five-year-olds come into school already quite expert on iOS. I mean, I look at Georgia, our youngest daughter, who's only two. She understands how to unlock the device. She understands how to dismiss a notification that pops up. With a little pull down and swipe away gesture that no adult can do in the world. she understands how to skip an ad on the YouTube app. You know, she's going to go to school 3 years from now with such an understanding of the basic mechanics of iOS that is replicated. You just have to go to a restaurant, go to, you know, a cafe somewhere, and you will see children all over using iOS devices or touchscreen devices, most likely iOS, but perhaps something else. And that mechanic, rather than a laptop mechanic, is so ingrained in them that you will have a very easy on, well, I say very easy, that's probably wrong, but you'll have probably a smoother on-ramp with the students than you will have with the teachers if you go iOS.
It really goes back to that earlier discussion about deploying iPads for the students and Chromebooks for yourself on some level. Mm-hmm. Just because I think you're right. I think the best student experience right now is the iPad, partially because they're native, you know, it feels like a native device to a lot of our students. I have a 4-year-old and a 15-month-old. They can both work an iPad and an iPhone. Mm-hmm. The four-year-old is actually quite sophisticated. She e-sparks on it. You know, she can actually go through a mission on the iPad, and we set goals for her and everything. It's amazing, and she's four, and it's what she will expect. I live we moved to a district when we moved out of the city that was iPad one-to-one because that was important to us. Mm-hmm. And now, looking at the long term of my own district, I just see that I see the iPad one-to-one, especially for the younger kids, as the only. It's sort of the de facto right now. There's not a great alternative. Chromebooks for young kids, they reinforce that physical barrier that, you know, laptops come with. Mm-hmm. They create that sort of barrier between the teacher and the student that I'm not nuts about. They create that barrier to collaboration because there's now a screen in front of your face and body. So I tend to agree, but I wonder what the tipping point will be.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, I kind of feel like parents are wondering what's taking us all so long in education. You know, I couldn't honestly say that our iPad program has had a huge impact on recruitment for our school. There are bigger factors at play than that, but I think it perhaps does help with retention. You know, the possibility of parents taking kids out of our school to go to a school where they don't have any technology program, that seems to be something that parents are slightly less keen to do. But I don't know that it necessarily recruits people. But what I know that when parents do come around the school, they often express to me sentiments like, well, of course you should have this. You know, why wouldn't you have it? It's good to see this kind of thing being done in school. And you know, my feeling certainly is that there are 80 to 90% of parents in every school in Scotland, and indeed most of the Western world who are just wondering why it's not already being done.
That's probably very true.
And that those are the kind of parent survey numbers that we see. You know, I go to schools a lot and I do their parents' evening, and quite often beforehand I'll ask the head teacher, you know, have you surveyed parents about their opinions about this potential program? And they say, yeah, we get 95% approval, you know, just for asking. You know, not for even having made concessions to recalcitrant groups or anything like that. They just say, well, yeah, we asked, and the first blush it was 90%. You know, and then we talked to a few people, and then we're up to 98%. You know, and once we allayed those people's fears, then we've got 99.5%. You know, and it's we're pushing it an open door with parents, I think, and it's just the structures that be that make it difficult for us to actually do it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience at Zavarian in particular, there was a lot more pushback internally than externally. People in the community are excited by something like a one-to-one initiative, even if they're not fully understanding of the moving parts or, you know, what value we think we're bringing to the table with it. So I think, it's most of the resistance came from, I guess, teachers who were concerned. And a lot of times, the longer the tenure, the more the concern. They don't want to be assessed in a new way. Yeah, that was my experience too. Parents were pretty on board, especially at Zavarian. They were excited to see what we were going to do. We had very little pushback from anyone outside the building. Almost all the pushback was inside.
Yeah, and I can see in a world where, you know, people are being, you know, evaluated by their performance in a certain way, then, you know, there would be concern about a new way of being evaluated coming in again. But, you know, I go back to that probationer teacher that came to visit us this week and thinking, you know, what she hasn't been taught anything about teaching with technology, but the power dynamic in the classroom changes so dramatically when you go one-to-one that, you know, how can we be putting teachers out into the world who they've not been taught any classroom management strategies for that kind of world. And it's, I suppose the only saving grace is they're probably not going to a one-to-one school. but that should change first, I suppose. Yeah. Well, shall we leave it there, Patrick? We've covered all kinds of ground, and I think it's been a great show, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's always nice to talk to you on the air or off, but this was particularly enlightening.
Great. Well, we'll wrap this up and we'll get this out. I've got to go and play with iTunes U3, which we could have had a whole show but just talking about that ourselves. But I'm going to go play with that now. I don't know much more about it than I've just read in the sort of 20 minutes before we came on the air. But we're going to go play with that now and get this show up for people as soon as we can.
Awesome. Terrific. Thanks so much for having me, Fraser.
Okay. Thanks, man.
It was a blast. Thank you.